Welcome to the Untold Tales audio anthologies. Written by Don Muchao and narrated by Melissa Del Toro Schaffner.
Coatl. I began transcribing these notes on my handheld before I realized that its power would not last. Therefore, I have taken to writing them down. I find myself in these circumstances due to a series of egregious errors on my part, the first of which was my failure to recognize that connecting two ailing 12-volt batteries in series does not supply more current, but rather more voltage. The second being my failure to realize that putting 24 volts through a marine radio will almost instantly kill it. The third was heading out without a life raft. As a coastal zoologist, I was asked by the University of Georgia Marine Institute to investigate reports of several new varieties of live bottom fauna washed into the mainland from barrier islands. Two aspects of the study intrigued me. First, the islands in question were newly formed, created no doubt from the violent winds and sea currents associated with a series of late summer storms, stretching back about 3 years. Second, the islands had arisen unusually far from the mainland, almost 75 miles out, near the edge of the continental shelf. On the leeward side of the island, I should expect to find the usual abundance of worms, crabs, and mollusks, while on the other side I might reasonably encounter a less common mixture of shallow and deep-water life forms. It was a rare opportunity for a young man, and owing to my untenured position at the Institute, a chance to cut my teeth on something big. I was to accompany Assistant Chief Zoologist Brian Haggerty on a day trip out to an island we had nicknamed Bone Beach, owing to the dirty white color of its sand. Haggerty had canceled at the last minute after reserving one of the Institute's three radon signature vessels, and trusting to navigational skills I had previously demonstrated, left it to me to equip the outing. To my disappointment, no one had time to accompany me that day, and not wanting to waste perfectly good weather and a chance at making a name for myself, I filed a trip manifest with the department secretary, left emergency contact information, gassed up the boat, packed a lunch, and set out alone around 8:30 a.m. Once in the open water, the currents ran swiftly north and in a long sweeping arc to the east. I rode light on the engine as I was making good time, and in about 3.5 hours, I had reached the near shore of the island. Whoever last had the boat had made off with a dinghy, and finding no good place to moor the boat, I ran it in as close as I could, killed the engine, and swam and waded the rest of the way to shore. The day, as I said, was beautiful, and the island, so bare from a distance, abounded with life. As I ate lunch, in a single hour I counted no fewer than 6 varieties of pennywort, 4 non-woody spike rushes, and a heretofore uncatalogued variety of small grayish-green translucent fiddler crab that fed on tidal detritus. To collect small specimens as I walked along the beach, I used the plastic zipper bag from lunch, but it quickly filled up. At first, I narrowed the scope of what I thought was worth a return to the mainland and switched over to using the pockets of my shorts and shirt. By the time I had reached the first turn in the shoreline, looking back to sight the boat, I realized that collecting enough samples would be impossible. I took out a paper notebook and began sketching what I saw and making short notes on each specimen's discovery environment, feeding habits, means of locomotion and predation, and whatever else I could observe. Even this, though, quickly reduced itself to a compact shorthand resembling the following, from my notes. 27. Marine decapod, gen. UCA. Species, Bergersi? Tidal detritivore, approximately 2.5 centimeters. Color, translucent green to gray, varying by gender, size. Sample observed feeding on remains of miscellaneous The Conidae, twice its size. Sketch follows. By the time I had cataloged just the tidal fauna I found on the short stretch on the leeward side of the island, I had filled 20 pages in this manner with almost 400 observations. I walked back toward the boat, following an inland route that led past a grove of astoundingly mature wax myrtle and an unusual mixture of blue-tinged oryx and weedy nutgrass that seemed to be home to a community of lizards. When I reached a spot near the apex of a line of secondary dunes, I planned to take a second set of notes, into the evening, as long as the light would allow. After that, I thought I might wade out to the boat and radio in that I was going to overnight on the island. The sunset was glorious, and I was treated to a profusion of ghost crabs and tiny sea turtles that emerged from the phosphorescent glow of the surf and crawled glistening out over the moist gray sand. Behind me, a cacophony of insects screeched and whirred, an alien orchestra of dozens of species that had doubtless never seen man. I watched, listening to the endless call-and-response liturgy of ocean and beach, and after a few minutes, I got up to go out to the signature. When I reached the boat, I realized with alarm that I had left running several navigational and scientific apparatus that consumed power. In effect, I had left the lights on when I parked the car. As far as I knew, there was still enough fuel for a return to the mainland, but I had not thought to check the starting battery, nor did I verify the charge on the main battery or the backup. Now, as I fished about looking for the spare, it occurred to me that I was worse off than it appeared. I had only packed food and water for one day. If the starter didn't work, I not only could not move, I could not even charge the battery well enough to even use the marine radio. I quickly verified with a voltmeter I found in the hold that the spare battery was indeed depleted to about 15% of capacity. The main battery was stone cold dead. Everything hinged on the starter. I took in the anchor, went back into the cabin, and actually crossed my fingers. The starter gulped and whinnied like a horse and caught the engine on the third try. I backed the boat around, revved the engine, then idled it while I went to check on the running lights and make sure that everything was fastened, battened down, I guess they say, for the trip. I hazarded turning on the marine radio, a device whose reliability is matched only by its inscrutability to the average consumer. It took me 4 tries to convince myself that I had an open channel and was sending a signal. UGMI Mainland, this is Signature 1. Do you copy? No answer. UGMI Mainland, this is Signature 1. Do you read me? Still, no answer. God damn it, somebody pick up! There was a hiss of static, then a mousy, scratchy female voice, barely recognizable as human.
Signature 1, this is UGMI Mainland. Please advise status and position.
Thank God. Charlotte, it's Dave Taylor. I'm just offshore at Bone Beach. Listen, my battery's... Then the engine skipped a beat, coughed, and died. I didn't have much choice about what to do next. The radio was dead and there wasn't any food on board, so I made my way back to the island to collect a few more specimens while I waited for someone from the university to arrive. The whole time, I stayed close to shore. 4 hours later, I felt like it was time to head back out and wait for someone to arrive. When I got back on the boat, I started thinking about what I had seen. I unloaded the specimens and reviewed my notes. In all, I had cataloged or collected almost 500 samples. While my laptop battery lasted, I was able to verify that at least 150 were new species, including my little friend the fiddler crab. 3 of the samples represented new or undiscovered genera. In such an environment, it was expected that existing species would adapt to exploit new opportunities. Marine fauna, bony fishes in particular, possess the most rapid speciation capability of all known chordates. But what surprised me was that at least one of the samples did not represent, even remotely, any animal I had seen before. I closed the screen of the laptop and sat back. As clouds gathered overhead, the temperature dropped, and the mist rolled in around the boat, the island, everything. I put the sample back into the sandwich bag and turned the laptop off to conserve power, then drifted off to sleep. I was a little surprised when I awoke and it was dark. What was keeping them? I grabbed my things and stored them in case of rain, tucked them under the corner of my jacket, and tried to sleep. It was, however, a long, uncomfortable, and fitful night. The entire time I dreamed of evolution gone wild. It was like watching the entire history of Earth play out in just a few hours. The next morning, I stayed with the boat until about noon, but had no luck with repeated attempts at starting it. It was at this point I decided that it might make sense to chance a short trip to the island to look for water-bearing succulents such as prickly pear, which were not uncommon on barrier islands, and other edible plants and fish, and to continue my cataloging. The radio was dead, the engine most likely flooded, and all I could do now was wait. By mid-afternoon, I had ventured even farther inland, and it was clear to me that the level of adaptation on Bone Beach was not only accelerated, but universal. Here, it seemed a tiny difference in habitability had given rise to new ways of foraging, new coloration, and even new types of body parts. I encountered insectivorous hopping snails, a type of burrowing orthopteran, and at least one species with the size, shape, and demeanor of a hummingbird, but it had the tail and scales of a fish or reptile. I chose to call these coatls, after the Central American legend. I watched as one of them flitted among cactus in the interdunal hollows, boring its stiff proboscis into the meaty flesh of a plant, then moving on into the distance at a high speed. One thing the listener should know. As I mentioned before, some types of fish can give rise, under the proper conditions, to new species in as little as 6 generations. Such changes are generally brought about by abrupt, persistent environmental stressors, such as the appearance or disappearance of a biome. Generally, the mechanism is thought to be accelerated mutation of the telomeres, the chromosomal structures which contribute to the process or mitosis during an organism's development. The discounted theories of Jean-Baptiste Delamarck, Darwin's contemporary, have a basis in fact. Species do adjust to rapid environmental change. Our own existence owes itself to this fact. That said, though speciation is common, the formation of new genera is rare, about once every few million years. New orders and classes even rarer, 20 to 100 million. And only occasionally in the history of Earth have new phyla formed, most notably during the Cambrian explosion. On this island alone, all but the last two had occurred in just 3 years. There had to be a compelling cause. It was ultimately the search for this cause which distracted me significantly enough to lose track of the time. At about 3:30 p.m., I heard crunching sounds in the underbrush to my right. Not really expecting to find large predators on an island so recently formed, I assumed that these must be the search party sent out to find me. So I made my way toward the sound, brushing away the sawgrass as loudly as I could.
"Hello?"
I shouted. The sound of the waves in the rustling grass and the soft, irregular contour of the land had a muting effect, and my voice seemed carried away on the wind. The crunching stopped briefly, then continued hesitantly.
"Hello?"
I repeated, waving my hands over my head.
"Over here!"
In retrospect, it would have reflected better planning for me to have carried a machete, for I was unarmed and had nothing with which to cut a path to the island's dense, overgrown interior. Even as I marveled at how thickly vegetated it had become in such a short time, I cursed its diversity for blocking the way to rescue. The crunching stopped again and seemed to move closer.
Charlotte? Dr. Haggerty! Over here!
As I crested a sandy rise carpeted in nutgrass and sandwort, I saw the outlines of two figures re-entering the forest about 100 yards from where I stood. I whistled as loudly as I could and waved as my life depended on it, which it probably did. The figures hesitated again, then turned. I guess I must have drawn some conclusions from the specimen sack the smaller of the two was holding, but these were not Charlotte or Brian. One of them was holding some sort of device that looked vaguely like it might be a gun, but not like any gun I've ever seen. He raised it to his waist and pointed it at me. I tried to duck, but lost my footing and sent myself tumbling backwards down the dune. I must have hit my head on driftwood and knocked myself out. The last thing I remembered before losing consciousness again was seeing them standing over me, with their coffee-colored skin, large, imploring eyes, and completely garbled speech. When I finally arose, it was 7 o'clock at night, and I was back on the beach on the other side of the island. The boat bobbed mockingly in the water just offshore, and the armada of ghost crabs and turtles was returning to forage. I swam out to the boat and tried starting the engine, at which point I made the mistake of connecting the two batteries in series. My only hope now was to wait for rescue. Since my chances of surviving were much better on the island, I devised a plan to keep the boat in sight, but to forage deeper into the thicket of vines and rhizomes in search of something edible. The prickly pear, it must be said, is not bad. At about 9 p.m., the two figures returned. This time, I resolved to track them down, overpower one of them, and hold him hostage until he explained why he had threatened me. But as I followed them, I became more disturbed by thoughts that have only now taken form. First, their behavior was clearly human despite their alien appearance. Second, almost to a twitch, their habits resembled my own protocols as a botanist and a zoologist. Third, was the fact that their language hovered at the edge of understandability. In a way, they were a mirror, an image of what I would be under a different set of circumstances. I watched for a while until the larger one approached a bare spot in the clearing, heavily laden with sample bags. The air crackled, there was a blue flash, and he was gone. The second followed, but not before I spotted a lumpy mottled thing about 9 inches in its major dimension that resembled a brachiating squid. It appeared where the man had been, for I know now that is what he must have been. Hopped gingerly from the burned spot in the clearing to one of the nearest trees and moved swiftly out of sight, screeching like a howler monkey. It is said that the introduction of dogs and pigs to Australia nearly wiped out the indigenous animal population. The release of kudzu in the Deep South, originally intended as an anti-erosion ground cover, had disastrous effects. History is littered with examples. Any attempt to wipe out invaders invariably made them stronger, taught them to adapt, and left us with killer bees, fire ants, and antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Here on this island, a place that had not existed a decade ago, evolution was proceeding at an even greater breakneck pace through the constant introduction of new genetic material and new environmental pressures. The effort was clearly deliberate, an accelerated experiment, perhaps, in adaptation. This island was a zoo, an accident, or a freak of nature. The truth cannot be far off. Why it exists, I don't know. But I am convinced that the burning spot in the mangrove forest was some sort of time gate, and that the two people who came through it were zoologists. Call it an educated guess, or fantasy, I don't care. I am back in that boat, and as the morning mist clears, in an hour or two, I hope I'll be rescued. Last night, as I hauled anchor, I found that the nylon cord had been eaten through. I'm drifting now. By the time that I am found, doubtless, the island will have changed again, perhaps even to unrecognizability, by forces and actions beyond my comprehension. Perhaps the whole adventure will be written off as the sun-baked dreams of an untenured graduate assistant, and things will soon be back to normal. But the koala in my pocket says otherwise. Thank you for listening. We love our listeners, fans, and patrons here at Untold Tales, and we hope you love the stories that we're bringing to you month after month on the first of each month. Please consider leaving us a review on Podchaser. Once again, thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.